Welcome back to the Clear Admit MBA Admissions Podcast. I'm your host, Graham Richmond, and this is your Wiretaps podcast for Monday, February 3rd, 2020. Welcoming back Alex Brown. How's your week been, Alex?
Very good, thank you.
Good. So this is a big week ahead. Tomorrow, I guess HBS interview invites for round two candidates are rolling out. And what else is kind of on the horizon? And also maybe give us a quick update as to what's happened in the last week on the kind of round two front.
Yeah, the big thing sort of last week, Chicago Booth started releasing its interview invites Wednesday of last week. So lots of excitement there, and certainly on LiveWire, we're seeing a lot of sort of engagement and interaction from applicants waiting to hear from Chicago, then hearing from Chicago and discussing it and so on and so forth. Obviously, Harvard's the big story for this upcoming week, and then the following week it'll be Wharton. But we are right in the middle now of sort of interview invite season. So, you know, some schools, they tend to trickle them out. So we'll see a lot of that next week with, you know, your typical schools like Yale and Haas will keep rolling out interview invites and so on and so forth. Then you have these sort of big, some of the schools that release them all at once or over a 2 or 3 day period like Chicago. That creates a sort of a big jump in sort of activity that we see. And obviously now it's sort of interview season, so candidates are preparing for those interviews, you know, hopefully taking advantage of a lot of the resources that we have in as much as our interview archive. We have a bunch of interview tips and so forth. So good luck to everybody that's interviewing and good luck to those still waiting for those interviews.
Yeah, and actually, you make a really good point. We do have a lot of resources to help. And the only thing I would say, because I don't want to beat a dead horse and just keep telling people to go to the same stuff on our site, but I think there's so many people that I met in my course of working in admissions and even in the past when working as like an admissions consultant who were sort of, they were so relieved to get an interview invite and had done so much work on the application. And we're fairly confident, I guess. They would sort of say, well, you know, look, the interview is the interview. I'll just head on in and I'll be myself. I'm good at this, you know. And I think that even the best candidates need to prepare for these interviews. So I highly encourage people to get a friend, family member, whoever's willing to listen and mock interview with them. Because that's just hearing yourself give answers to some of the standard questions will go miles and miles in terms of helping you prepare. And I think sometimes people just don't recognize that they need to be able to tell a coherent, concise story to have a successful interview. So yeah, just do your background work, use our interview archive, use the tips we've been publishing. And we even have done a couple of podcasts where we go over like the 7 hardest interview questions and how to answer them or how to interview at HBS. We've got a Wharton interview prep podcast as well. So check out all that stuff. But yeah, this is busy time. I did want to mention just a couple other news items of note. So MIT secured STEM certification for 3 of their MBA programs. As you know, they offer, I guess they also offer kind of executive stuff. And so, but the main MBA program now has STEM. Well, this is like just yet another school. It seems like all the top schools are coming in line and trying to get this certification, which allows for international candidates who are non-US folk to stay and work for up to 3 years in the United States, assuming their job also qualifies. But in any event, so this is another thing we've just been seeing. We also have that Tuck, that Dartmouth Tuck chat coming up on the website on February 11th, where our site users can jump on and actually interact with some Tuck's current students and maybe admission staff. So that should be fun. Stay tuned. I think all the info is on the site if you want to sign up. And lastly, you know, Clay Christensen, who was a professor at HBS, very famous in the world of management, he passed away last week, and I just wanted to mention that. He's particularly well known for the concept of disruptive innovation. He wrote that book, The Innovator's Dilemma, and I'm just going to read a quick quote to help people understand what that means. And he basically said that a true disruptive innovation first appeals only to a niche market and appears less attractive than the powerful incumbent that it eventually usurps. In fact, you know, the incumbent typically looks down on it as inconsequential until it eats up huge swaths of its market share. And so just to think of a concept, one concept that sort of fits this bill would be like video streaming. You know, I don't think that Blockbuster or these other outlets that used to rent videos or DVDs really saw, you know, Netflix coming and what it would do, or even, you know, even the likes of cable operators really saw what Netflix was going to do to the industry. So yeah, we send rest in peace to Clay Christensen. And the only other thing we should talk about, Alex, I realize, is the FT rankings, Financial Times rankings of MBA programs came out last week. And do you have any thoughts? I mean, this was, this is a big ranking, especially for MBA applicants outside of the U.S. This is, I would argue, the ranking that people look to. I think in America, there's a bit more of a preference for, say, U.S. news, but that ranking doesn't include any international programs. So globally, people like the FT because it combines all markets. But what are your thoughts on the rankings? We know that Harvard came in number one, but any thoughts that you have?
Obviously, we have sort of mixed feelings in terms of one ranking sort of combining MBA programs from around the world, because it is quite difficult to measure different MBA programs in different geographies based on, candidates' preferences for where they want to work and so on and so forth. I will say, if you pull out the US schools and look at the order that are presented in Financial Times, congratulations to the FT, they pretty much got that right. Based on sort of my understanding of the order, based on sort of observing decision-wide data and so on and so forth. I'm not saying all, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 exactly right, but certainly the top three are the top three that we see on Decision Wire, and the top seven are the top seven, and then the top 16 are the top 16, and so on and so forth. And it looks like, Graham, that they've got the order reasonably well developed in the European market and in the Asia market. How do you see that on this year's rankings?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as you say, it's really tricky to combine these markets, right? And I know, but you make a great point. I mean, the U.S. schools, they've got, what we would argue the M7 and then that next group of seven schools. They're all there. Some of the ordering might be slightly off, but it's roughly there. With the Europe and Asia market, you see schools like INSEAD, Siebes, LBS, HEC Paris, ESA. I mean, all the big names are there, Oxford and Cambridge, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, ESADE. So they're here. I think it's tricky. I think INSEAD might be the best program in both Europe and Asia, right? Because they have that campus in Singapore and in Fontainebleau, France. So, but then Siebes is likely, the next one that people think of in Asia. When it comes to the European market, obviously London Business School and INSEAD are, kind of ruling the roost. The big thing I noted with this year's ranking is the kind of rise of HEC Paris. They moved into number 9 on the list this year, and they had been number 19 last year. So that's a massive leap. You rarely see a school jump 10 slots, although I should give a shout out to USC Marshall, which also jumped up 10 spots, although, they didn't crack the top 10 or anything, but they did move up from 46 to 36. Which again, we strip out all the non-US schools, places them relatively high in the kind of American school ranking within this group. I also think, Kellogg moved up from 11 into the top 10. They're now, where are they? Let's see. They nearly cracked the top 10, sorry. They're at number 11 and they moved up three spots. So they're close. NYU Stern bumped up a few spots, and Darden actually moved up five spots from 23 to 18. So there's been, a fair amount of movement. I will say, Stanford's probably not so happy. I mean, they were number one last year, and they didn't only lose their number one slot, but they actually were passed by both Harvard and Wharton. And I think Wharton's probably pretty happy. They were number four last year, so they actually managed to jump over INSEAD and Stanford to get into their number two spot this year. Those are my, one other thing. I don't know what happened, but Oxford actually slipped eight spots down to number 21. So I don't know what's going on and what sort of drove that. Again, this is around, alumni outcomes and things, as you see with the FT. So in any event, overall, we like this ranking. I think I would say, alongside U.S. News, we always say use multiple rankings. This is definitely one of the ones we recommend people, look at.
We also, recognize using the rankings is good at the beginning of your research for sort of the sort of schools you want to apply to and consider. But please don't make them your only sort of decision-making factor, because each of these rankings will show sort of some different outcomes. So you need to understand the methodologies and various other things. And again, we have a lot of data off of DecisionWire, and we do have a real good sense of how, you know, from a customer standpoint, i.e. from the student standpoint, where they're choosing over which schools. So that allows us to, I think, provide a little bit of commentary on the different rankings that come out. And yeah, I would agree with you, Graham. I think Financial Times and US News are the two that sort of do the best job of reflecting the reality of the marketplace as we see it on DecisionWire.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's dive in. We're going to do a couple of ApplyWire reviews and one DecisionWire review, as we've been doing on recent episodes. Before we do that, I just wanted to mention that our podcast sponsor is the Evening and Weekend Program at the Kellogg School of Management. You can reach your highest career goals while earning an MBA part-time. The Evening and Weekend MBA Program at the Kellogg School of Management, conveniently located at their downtown Chicago campus, offers flexible study options to fit your lifestyle and match your experience. By graduation, you share the same toolkit, skills, and network as the school's most prominent alumni. Visit kellogg.northwestern.edu/EW. And we thank Kellogg for their support. And again, we'd mentioned this last week, but I think we do see, I've been talking to some schools, you see a kind of rise and an increase in interest in part-time offerings when the economy is really hot. And so, you know, heading off to Kellogg's part-time program, if you're in the, you know, kind of geography that suits that, could make a lot of sense. So again, thanks to Kellogg for their sponsorship. Alex, how do you want to do this? Do you want to do ApplyWire first or DecisionWire? Do you have a preference?
Yeah, let's do ApplyWire first today. We swapped it around last week.
All right. So let's move on and then discuss Wiretap's candidate number one. So this ApplyWire entry is a candidate that is looking at Berkeley, Columbia, Dartmouth, Duke, MIT, Kellogg, Chicago, UCLA, Penn, Wharton, USC, and UT Austin McCombs. And they want to start in the fall of 2021. They are, they've done some strategy consulting as well as work in the kind of wine and spirits, or kind of food and bev domain. And post-MBA, they want to get into consumer goods. Well, that's at least one of the tracks they're considering. And they have a GRE score of 323, a GPA of 3.84. They've been working for 3 years, currently located in LA, and they want to live in an urban U.S. city when they're done with business school. A little more background is that they graduated magna cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from UCLA in 2016, and they majored in econ, minored in entrepreneurship. As I said, overall very high GPA. I guess overall GPA was 3.81, they say, and the GPA in their major was 3.84. They're kind of asking the question about what are their chances? And you had an interesting discussion with them because of the sort of trajectory that they followed post college in terms of their career track. And, you know, they were in consulting and now they're in kind of wine and spirits. So do you want to just talk a little about that? Because I think you asked them a good question about that change.
Sure. The thing that stood out to me, and obviously this candidate is smart, the 3.84 and doing well in their undergraduate is obviously very good. And as a result of that, they start off in sort of strategy consulting. They have a good position there. And they worked there for a year and three quarters. So that sort of stood out to me. I'm like, that year and three quarters sounds a bit odd. Usually you see 2 years and then go off do something else. And then they took a four-month, you know, sabbatical or whatever you want to call it, did some travel, and then went into working for this sort of wine business, direct-to-consumer wine business. I think that's how they qualify. So I needed to ask. I wanted to ask why the year and three quarters and why the break. And this is important, I think, and I wanted to share this in the podcast. If you do have something unorthodox or unusual in your sort of career progression, you want to face it right up front and be honest about it, as you articulated in your applications, because the outcome is immediately going to look at this particular issue and think the worst, right? So you need to reassure that the outcome, that there were good reasons for the decision to leave after a year and three quarters, to take the break, and then to move into what looks like a good role with good progression, now in a management position. And the candidate had, I thought, a very good explanation, Graham. They realised after a period of time that, frankly, they felt consulting was too transaction-based. I guess you just work for this one client for 3 months, you give them your work output, you go on, you work for another client for X months, give them your work output, and just keep moving on. And because of the hectic schedule of consulting, it was difficult to recruit for that next step, so they took the break. So I actually thought that this person's decision to leave, to take the few months break, and then to move into the next position, is actually almost a courageous choice, because a lot of candidates, I think, would have stayed for the 2 years, at, kind of sucked it up, and then moved on.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think they have a coherent story. I guess you're right. I mean, more often people stay for, usually you're right. Like when you see a candidate who's less than 2 years at any given post, it can raise an eyebrow. Although I think that's changing. I mean, I think that, more and more we have these kind of folks who are a bit more nomadic and moving around. And so I think it's fine. I guess the key will be for them to just explain it as they've done to us. And I think they have good reasons. And it's not like they didn't land a good job afterwards. And they've actually done quite well. I believe they've been promoted within, like a couple of months of landing in the new job, and that the place that they're working for is a top 25 domestic producer of wine and spirits. So it's a growing entity, and they're very actively involved in that. And so I think that on the one hand, this actually makes them stand out a bit, in the sense that there are going to be a lot of strategy consultants applying to school, but very few will have managed to actually make the leap into a business and demonstrate, putting to use their skill set as a strategist in that kind of single company environment. And so I think it's good. I also like that they're in the kind of food and beverage industry, which is less common. And it does seem from their goals like they're maybe headed back that way. I was actually thinking it'd be great if their story was to stay specifically focused in food and beverage. I remember, looking at some of the career reports recently, a lot of these food and beverage companies, the big ones at least, are recruiting MBAs. So it's not a weird goal to have. It's just a less, maybe less common. Not everyone, it's not like Amazon or McKinsey, but these big companies, whether it's InBev or I can't remember the names of some of the other ones, they come to the MBA campuses. And so this, to the extent that this person could weave together this passion for food and beverage that maybe they have, that might be interesting, as to give it more of a thread in terms of a connection between their past experiences and their future. The big thing here, I think we also need to discuss, is the GRE, right? So they have a 323 and a 321, because they've taken it twice. And, in the first sitting of the exam where they got the 323, they hit the 90th percentile on verbal and the 76th percentile on math. And then they took it again and they got a lower overall score, 321. But on the verbal, they had 80th percent. So they dropped 10% on verbal, but they moved the math up to the 82nd percentile. So I think if they don't take it again and try to get a better score overall, which it sounds like they're leaning away from doing, if I were them, I would write a little supplemental note saying, look, I took the test twice. 323 is the best I secured. But if you look at my percentiles in the two exams, you'll see that I have achieved as high as 90th percent on verbal and 82nd percent on math. Because those two combined would actually probably be more like a 325 or something. So which puts them more in the ballpark for average scores at the very top, schools. So I think given their list, which has some variety on it, but the top end of their list, they're going to fall short when it comes to GRE. And that's not the end all be all. I mean, this person's magna cum laude, as we said, and Phi Beta Kappa, great, but I just think, that it doesn't help them. Right now, the GRE is kind of, it's not necessarily dragging them down, but it's not really helping their case. And so if anything, it could be a small liability and they might be better off explaining it. So that's my take on this person. But I like them. I think they can get into these schools.
Yeah, I like them. And like I say, the last couple of years' work experience looks really good to me. I think making that choice and then I would imagine lots of impact and so on and so forth, which is what the outcome is going to be looking at, as a result of their experience. over the next year, so they have a little bit of time in terms of when they're actually going to apply. They asked this one question right at the end: if I could do one of two things, retake the GRE or get more involved in my sort of volunteer activities, which should I pursue? What would be your quick answer to that, Graham?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, I guess I don't have a great understanding of how active they are right now. I mean, they mentioned a few things.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something they need to develop a little bit further to truly stand out. My sense is their work experience really helps them stand out, quite frankly. But I don't think their ECs at this point reinforce that.
Yeah, I would probably argue, you know, extracurriculars. I think, I mean, they've taken the GRE twice. They can make a plausible case for, look, I did pretty well on each section, just not on the same test sitting. So, it's not like their overall score of 323 is like, I mean, it's actually quite average for some of the schools they're looking at. It's just below average for the top schools.
And their GPA and that is fantastic. So
will help.
So that absolutely helps.
So I lean towards focus on extracurriculars, if I've got to give you a single answer there.
Yeah. Perfect.
All right, so let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number two. So this person is applying to Columbia, Duke, Harvard, MIT, Kellogg, Rice, SMU, Chicago, Penn, UT Austin, and Darden, a long list of schools. And they also looking to start, like our first ApplyWire person, in 2021. And their pre-MBA career has been largely in commercial banking, commercial finance, and they're looking to get into private equity or asset management, maybe hedge funds, stuff like that. And they're looking at Bain Capital, Blackstone, Carlyle Group, Goldman, TPG and KKR. So lots of the big names there. 6 years of work experience to date. I believe they mentioned to us in the comments they're about 28 years old. And they have a GPA of 2.75, located in Texas and hoping to live kind of anywhere in the U.S. after school. And, you know, they haven't taken the GMAT yet. And Alex, I'm guessing that you picked this candidate because they have a really interesting, you know, dilemma. They have a very low GPA, as I mentioned, 2.75. And they have a really interesting background story in which they tell us they were quasi-homeless growing up in the southeast of Texas. Their mother was a heroin addict and father was an alcoholic. And so the person kind of moved around a ton, but found some stability in high school where he began playing football. First to graduate high school in the family and, you know, had all these Division I scholarship offers for college, ended up at Baylor, playing football and basically heading towards the NFL. That was the plan. Injuries ultimately derailed that plan. And, then this guy kind of had to get his act together and start working pretty hard academically and was able to kind of bring the GPA up to 2.75 because, you know, prior he'd been so focused on football and other things. So that's kind of the background. And then networked his way into a job at GE Capital. Within their kind of commercial finance business. And the other interesting thing about this person is they then took a break. So they did that like 4 years, took a break for a year to work with a church, a kind of nonprofit, doing like homeless outreach and 12-step addiction recovery stuff. And that was all around, you know, coming to grips and terms with, you know, what they had experienced, I guess, as a young person and wanting to help others in that domain. And so after they did that for a year, they went back into kind of finance. And so that's the backstory. But Alex, you had some additional dialogue with this person on the site, and this is an interesting case. Do you think that schools are going to be able to look past this 2.75? Or what's going to happen with this candidate?
Yeah, very interesting case indeed. And there's a couple of things that I wanted to highlight from this case. On the one hand, obviously the 2.75 GPA is really going to stand out. The candidate claims they're going to be able to get a GMAT after lots and lots of preparation, no doubt, between 7:10 and 7:30. That would be fantastic if they are able to do that. So they really need to double down and prepare and show that they have that academic aptitude as well as the academic motivation to do really well in business school. So on the one hand, doing very well in the GMAT will help. They're also doing HBS core, I think that's what it's called, to excel and do very well in that. Should they also take additional classes, get A's or whatever, if they can, that would be fantastic. But the point is, they're really sort of focusing on that aspect of the application to try to shore it up, recognizing that that's their weak spot. Their life story is absolutely fascinating. You know, it's dreadful. On the one hand, you know, as a young kid dealing with whatever they had to deal with, they worked their way to college. They saw football as their way out. I mean, we hear these stories time and time again. I guess, you know, you watch movies about it, so it's stories that people can understand, even if they don't really have empathy for. I mean, hopefully they don't have empathy for, because I mean, it seems like this person's come from a really, really tough beginning. And they've done really well, I would argue. You know, when football and getting into the NFL was the goal, they doubled down, focused on that. Unfortunately, injuries got in the way and sort of derailed that ambition. So then they had to double down, try to get that GPA up a little bit. They bootstrapped their way into a good career position with GE Capital. Then after a four-year period, they went to sort of give back to their communities, or he went to give back to his communities. That's fantastic. Now he's back in commercial banking. So I like all that. The one other thing that I will want to focus on with this candidate, though, Graham, is his goal. He wants to work in private equity. And you listed the companies. And, you know, I push back on that with the candidate, because I said, look, you've got to be realistic about your goals. You know, even if you get into the very best school in the land, getting into private equity without the requisite experience is extremely difficult. And then his response was, yes, but that's my dream. That's my focus. I really want to caution this candidate to using this as his goal in those MBA applications. Try to ratchet back, be more realistic, whether it's iBanking or asset management or something that's a little bit more realistic, that then could put them on the pathway to private equity in the long run. But if that's their initial goal coming out of school, some of the MBA programs will view the application negatively because of the naivety of that goal.
Yeah, I think this person could get into PE in the long term. There's no doubt. If they go to a top MBA program and do their thing, you know, that'll be fine. And they're obviously a driven individual and are going to make it happen. But I do agree that for better or for worse, commercial banking is not viewed as the same way as like investment banking. So there's, you know, it's kind of the next tier down. And so they worked with good brands. You know, they worked at GE Capital. They're now at Bank of America. But again, those jobs are less coveted out of undergrad than the jobs at like, you know, Goldman or, you know, the big time investment banks. And so, yeah, it would almost make more sense to me if they were saying, look, I love finance, been doing quite well. But, you know, given my kind of undergraduate experience and, you know, the sort of path I've traveled, it'd be great to, you know, learn more, get an MBA and get into an investment banking job. And then long term, I want to do private equity. Like that would make a lot of sense to me. So in any event, I think they will have to nail the GMAT. I actually think 710, 730 would be great. 750 would be incredible, but I recognize that's not easy. But I think if they want to quiet the concerns around the GPA, they're going to have to really nail the GMAT. I think that's just going to be, you know, a pretty important component here because they have to demonstrate that they're academically capable of surviving, you know, the core curriculum in these programs. And, you know, there could be some question marks around that for now. So, but I think this person, I mean, yeah, amazing experience. I would encourage them to apply to fewer schools. So I didn't even count, but I think they have like 10 or more schools on their list. It's sort of like M7 plus, you know, a few Texas schools plus Duke and Darden. And so, you know, it's a lot of schools. And I think, as you and I know from seeing candidates do this over and over again, it can be challenging to put together more than like 6 or even 7 high quality, you know, applications. So I encourage this person to maybe dial that back, really think about what are the programs they'd really want to end up in, or also split across rounds. You know, they might start with some of those M7 schools in round one and maybe one safety, and then leave some of the others and the rest of it for round two. Or so there's a lot, they have a lot of time.
Yeah. And I would actually frankly say, yeah, obviously pair back the schools, but also add in, you know, like Cornell Johnson would be an obvious choice for me, based on their finance ambition and the, you know, the type of school that it is and so forth. I absolutely agree with you. Completely nail that GMAT and prepare, and take it with enough time that you need to retake the test if that's necessary. You know, the average candidate now probably takes the standardized test, you know, a couple of times. I don't know what the statistic absolutely is, but don't be afraid to retake the test if you don't absolutely kick it out of the ballpark, pun intended, although I don't think he played ballpark, right? That's baseball, but anyway, kick it out of the football stadium. But yeah, absolutely fascinating story. You, again, and I've talked about this before, this is the sort of candidate AgCon will really be rooting for, if they can get all their ducks in a row. So I'm really hoping that they can do that.
Yeah, and I need only say, you know, first in family to high school. I mean, that's,
I know.
It's like, you know, that's not easy, right? So I think, yeah, we hear first in family to get a college degree. Okay, you know, that's something too, right? But this is, you know, definitely an extreme situation. Let's move on and talk about Wiretap's candidate number 3. So this is our Decision Wire entry for the week, and it's a pretty simple battle. We've got a candidate who's been admitted to MIT Sloan and to Wharton, and they don't know where to go. They did apply to Harvard, Stanford, obviously MIT and Wharton, but they just are ending up with MIT and Wharton as the schools that have made them offers. They're going to start this fall, and they say they want to work in venture capital, and they have a 740 GMAT, 3.6 GPA. They used to be in investment banking, and they're currently an energy investor, and they're torn, you know, on this thing. And they say, I couldn't be less of an engineer. I intend to work in clean energy and help build a business, initially corporate development. I'm not interested in iBanking or, you know, McKinsey, Bain, BCG consulting. MIT has a more active clean energy ecosystem and is potentially more additive given my finance background versus Wharton's alumni base, rank, and resources. So that's what they're kind of struggling with. There were a whole bunch of comments left not only by you, but also by just people, you know, on the site who, I guess some of whom are in the same position. I would say the voices from the crowd seem to be saying that MIT does have a better ecosystem and that the Boston area might be better for this energy-related stuff. What's your take? I mean, I know you and I, just full disclosure, we always say this, we have some affiliation to Wharton. I have an MBA from the school. You worked in admissions there. That's actually how we met. So I know that people always talk about how we love Wharton, but what is your take on this? This is an interesting dilemma, I think.
Yeah, quite frankly, Graham, I'll just bounce it directly back to you, because I think before we came on air, you explained the two choices very succinctly and very sort of, I would say, accurately, admitting that, again, we couldn't actually come up with a definitive answer, but I think you weighed the sort of two schools' pros and cons very, very well, Graham.
Yeah, and you know, I think our goal with these Decision Wire discussions is never to be too prescriptive, right? We want to just have people, you know, be informed and make the decision. And so I'm not going to tell this person where to go, but I think it does come down to the fact that these are both superb schools. You know, they're arguably, I mean, they're both M7. They're both great schools, and they're but they're different schools, right? So I think that's something I would be thinking about if I were the candidate, that the 2 years I'm going to spend are going to be very different in these programs. And that starts even with the core curricula. Obviously, at MIT, they have a fairly abbreviated core. There's a lot more self-direction that you can take. And so it's just that there's not the same kind of full year core curriculum that you see at a place like Wharton. So that's a difference. And that means different things for your interaction with your classmates. I should also mention that, you know, these schools are really different in size too. So, you know, Wharton's a lot bigger than MIT. And that plays a role too, I think, in the type of environment that someone would experience. And that could go either way, right? Depending on your preferences. you know, the person even alluded to this. Obviously, Wharton does tend to win out when it comes to the, you know, alumni base. If we're talking about MBA graduates and in ranking, Wharton's generally viewed as the being in that tier with maybe Harvard and Stanford, and MIT's maybe just in that next group. So and resources, right? So there's probably more course offerings and things like that. So these are things to consider. I think that the person. Yeah, I guess, I don't know if they mentioned this anywhere, but one thing to think about is just the difference in the two cities, right? So Philadelphia, I would argue there are very few people at Wharton who are from Philadelphia. And that makes for a certain type of kind of environment in terms of like a close-knit nature of the student body. Boston's not quite New York, but there will be some kids at MIT who probably were in Boston prior and have their own networks there. So that makes for a little bit of a difference, I think. There's also a fairly significant difference in cost of living between the two cities. Again, these are minor things to consider, but I where I came down on in the end was I think this person should go to the welcome events. I don't think they're on the same weekend, so hopefully they can attend both welcome events and just see what they think of their future classmates, because I think that's a really important part of this too. I have no doubt that this candidate will excel in VC and do, you know, they're already doing energy investing. They probably have a network. They're going to do well. And so I think it comes down to where do they think they're going to be most comfortable and where they'll learn the most. I do understand what they're saying when they say, look, I'm kind of a finance guy. I've been doing banking. Do I need a Wharton degree? Wouldn't MIT help kind of make me maybe more kind of tech and engineering focused when people look at my resume? And so there's some of that. I think that's it's a fair argument, but I would encourage them to go to the welcome events and just see what they think of their future peers, because those are the people you're going to spend the 2 years with and learn from in class. So and obviously do all the regular stuff. Connect with the energy club at each school. See what you think. But this is a tough call. I agree. It's really a hard decision to make.
Yeah, I think it's a tough call. What I'm going to do, Graham, if just indulge me for a minute, I'm going to read out a comment on this decision wire entry. And I'm reading it out because this commenter has 40 likes, Graham. And that's a little more than you. So I think you need to be contributing a little bit more to this these conversations. Right, okay. You're being beaten by one of our community members, which is very good. All but right. I think it's a good comment too. So let me read this out.
Okay.
And it sort of reflects some of the quality commentary that goes on DecisionWire to help candidates support each other in making these very difficult decisions. So here we go. I had a similar decision and picked MIT for clean energy investing. Upon researching the MIT Sustainability Initiative, the Clean Energy Prize, and the Sustainability Certificate, etc., I found that MIT has the edge here, in my opinion. I spoke with a few second years in the distinct clubs, and seems that they all had it figured out. Professors like John Sturman and Rigo Bon seem like great resources for the field and have a ton of contacts. Other than that, the programs are a bit different, so fit can play a big part. I also have a New York investment banking background and felt that going to Wharton was kind of the same profile. I was attracted by the MIT down-to-earth persona, but everyone is different and pros and cons with each. You can't go wrong with either decision. Best of luck. And obviously this person sort of boosting for MIT a little bit over Wharton, but I do think it's a fair reflection of the type of quality feedback that fellow candidates are providing each other. So that was absolutely fantastic. So back to you, Graham, and I think we can wrap it up.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, I'm glad you read that out, because it does demonstrate, you know, people are giving each other great advice. And that's why we built DecisionWire. It wasn't just for us to weigh in, you know, it's for everyone. So great advice there from, sounds like a current student, and you know, or maybe it's someone who's going off it in this fall, but it's still very good advice. Thanks as always, Alex, for, you know, picking out some great entries. And, you know, I'm excited. This coming week's a big one with HBS. We're going to see all kinds of activity. And hopefully, you know, as the season goes on here, we'll get into some more DecisionWire discussions. And I think there are going to be some really good matchups. And especially as we see schools offering more scholarship dollars than we've ever seen in the past. So that's it for this week. Any closing remarks, Alex, before we wrap it up?
Very good. And hopefully you'll get a few more likes next week.
I'll be working on it.
Very good.
All right. Thanks, Alex. We'll see you next week. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Cheers.